Because the future, if there was going to be a future for the student, was in rock and roll or it was in revolution. But over the years, you'd noticed that you didn't see those anymore. The Berlin Wall fell, the Soviet bloc melted away, the idea of Karl Marx being the solution to anything seemed absurd now. And rock and roll music had descended into something very commercial and had, you know, less heroic about it. But instead, you'd see posters of, usually it would be Oscar Wilde and Albert Einstein, because the future of mankind is in the mind, the creative mind. And those two represent it perhaps above all, too. They are, to use a word that actually annoys me, they are icons.
This is The Gould Standard, episode 64. Stephen Fry, lovable legend.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. We're here once again bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable and, in fact, adorable people from across the world of the arts. First, while you're stopping by under our neon piano sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And while you're at it, please check out some of our past programs with the likes of Laurie Anderson, Wynton Marsalis, Philippe Starck, Ai Weiwei, Barbara Hannigan, Jordi Savall, Viggo Mortensen, Hilary Hahn, and many more. We also invite you to pay us a visit at our website, glenngould.ca. If you are there and notice the donate button, we would be thrilled and honored if you would make a gift to the Glenn Gould Foundation. We'd love to have you as a supporter. Now, without further ado, we today have a return visit with one of our very favorite guests, Stephen Fry. As the crib notes say, Stephen is a frighteningly prolific English actor, broadcaster, comedian, television host, columnist, audiobook reader, and writer. He is also an acclaimed memoirist. He's techno-curious, and for those of us who are sometimes a little techno-hesitant, a friendly guide to the perplexing world of gadgetry. Also, he's an explicator of mythology, and that barely scratches the surface of his astonishing list of accomplishments. He is among the most articulate and witty mortals among us, with a seemingly encyclopedic knowledge concerning just about everything. And what keeps him from being either intimidating or simply annoying is the fact that he is also unstintingly kind, generous, and in short, a benevolent presence. No matter how gloomy the world may seem, I can always reassure myself with the reflection, all is not lost, we still have Stephen Fry. So, Stephen, welcome
back.
Wow. It's good to have
you. Talk about setting someone up to fail, my goodness me.
Not at all.
No, I'm very touched by that introduction, thank you.
Well, all sincerely meant, and you know, in our last conversation, I have a couple of primary things, but we did talk, I was reviewing our previous conversation, we talked at some length about your relationship with the television medium, but you're also an equally frequent presence in the world of feature films. And sort of as I was thinking about this last night, I wanted to ask you about three in particular that are quite near to my heart, so just as a self-indulgence, Wild, V for Vendetta, and Gosford Park. That's quite a gamut. But if you might share reflections about each of those, just, you know, to kick us off.
Well, happily, we may well return to the subject of the film Wilde, Oscar Wilde himself. In film terms, it was an astonishing moment when I was called by my agent and said there was interest from the producer, Mark Samerson, who was making a film. It was written by Julian Mitchell, who was someone I admired. I'd loved Another Country, a play he wrote, which made stars of Ken Branagh and the wonderful Rupert Everett as well. And I thought, well, maybe they just have a look at me just out of politeness or something. It had never occurred to me that I would play Wilde, although, oddly enough, some years earlier, I'd been in a restaurant, Joe Allen's, famous for actors and others. And I was in the loo and I was just washing my hands and I suddenly looked up and in the mirror I saw Alan Bennett And he said, you know, I was looking at you. And I thought, oh, my goodness, is he going to proposition me? And he said, I think you ought to play Oscar Wilde one day. And it had never occurred to me. And then
really?
When I got home, I parted my hair in the middle and I thought, I am putting on a bit of weight, because to be fair to Oscar, he was a large man in all ways. I thought, well, maybe one day I will. I pictured perhaps devising a stage show like the great Irish actor Michael McLearmore, whose importance of being Oscar was toured for many, many years and inspired many, many people. But this film idea, my goodness, when it arrived, I'd seen the films of both Robert Morley and Peter Finch, the great Australian actor, and I thought they would be pretty hard to beat in many ways, except that we were now in the 90s, and the slightly timorous attitude towards, you know, same-sex activity that existed in the early 60s when both films were made at more or less the same time. Famously, Robert Morley sent a telegram to Peter Finch as they both began production and said, good luck, dear. My Bosie is prettier than yours. Rather sweet. So you can see the films and judge for yourself. But anyway, I had a very high doctrine of Oscar, as you might say. I mean, I didn't want a film in which he was presented as some sort of camp figure, a peacocky figure, a pleased spouter of epithets and epigrams. And nor did I want an over-serious, or I don't mean over-serious, I mean a kind of self-righteous presentation of a kind of gay icon hero in which he took on qualities that were not his or those of his age. And so I was stunned by the script. And it was a difficult... I had to jump through a few hoops, not in any way auditioning, but I'd had a bit of a disaster just the year before. I'd been in a play from which I'd escaped. I'd had what we easily call a mental, you know, lapse, a nervous breakdown is the old phrase for it. I was just climbing out of it. And they... Well, obviously, the underwriters were worried that maybe I might do the same thing again. So I had to sort of show them psychiatrist reports and things like that to show that I was sort of on the mend. But that was fine. I was happy to do that. Then I had a meeting after I met with the director. They rather sweetly said, let's meet in the Savoy Hotel, because that's very important in Oscar's life. It's in a good way and a bad. He would take sweets there for writing when he wanted to get away from his lover, Bosie, Lord Alfred Douglas. And unfortunately, in his trial, the chambermaids and others testified as to the presence of young males in his room, and even describing the sheets. I mean, the squalor of it all, the horror of it all. But it was a nice thing that they thought of having the meeting there. And a couple of days later, I met this young actor, Jude Law, whom I realised immediately would be a magnificent Bosie, and indeed he was. And the rest of the casting fell into place magnificently. A young actor who was completely unknown, playing Wilde's best friend, Robbie Ross, the executor of his will, and his first male lover, in fact. Robbie Ross wrote that he seduced Oscar when Robbie was, I don't know, still a teenager, I think 18 or 19. And that was Michael Sheen. So it was a good piece of casting, to say the least. And it turned out to be a magnificent experience, enhanced by the fact that we had as a consultant Merlin Holland, who is Oscar's grandson, which seems amazing. Oscar died in 1900. He was born in the 1860s. It seems extraordinary to think that his grandson would be alive now when, you know, Freud's great-grandson is a middle-aged man, you know, and so on. But he had two children, Oscar, Cyril and Vivian. Cyril died, was the older, and died quite early on in the First World War. Generally, I think he understood slightly more of what went on during the trial of his father. And he threw himself against the guns, really. I think he was very anxious to prove his manliness and so forth. You know, it must have been a terrible, terrible experience for him. But his the younger son, Vivian Holland, they took on them the name that their mother had given them after Wilde's trial. He lived a long life and had a late second marriage, and that was the fruit of which was Merlin, who is a marvellous man and a great Oscar scholar. was very kind to us. And it was just an extraordinary experience because his physiognomy is similar to Oscar's. You could absolutely see the likeness and just to touch him and to think that I was connected.
Yeah, remarkable.
It was a marvellous feeling. And to film in, you know, some of the... We filmed in Magdalen College, Oxford, at the very place where Oscar and Bosie were educated and where they met. And we, you know, we put our hands together on a stone bridge where there's a photograph of them exactly putting their hands there. And these things are wonderful. I mean, even if they're only something that warms and, you know, gives you a glow of connection. And, you know, I won't go so far as it alters your performance exactly, but it that sort of... feeling that you are in the right place doing, you know, enacting, following in the footsteps. Fantastic feeling.
And one of the things I that particularly endears me to the film was the decision in the screenplay to treat the selfish giant as a sort of a leitmotif. Because even though it's a children's story, ostensibly, it's one of Wilde's works that I find most particularly affecting because of its lack of pretension and its use of a sort of a fantastic fictive structure. But and even though the religious elements of it are not mine, it still has such a power to move me as you know only a few pieces of literature do, and some of them are also children's stories. So I thought that was particularly affecting and also, in a sense, reflected a certain innocence of spirit that was part of Wilde's character. You know, when he was destroyed, it seems as though it almost came as a shock that you know he had been, he was at such risk, seems to have never really occurred to him.
No, that's right. And it's a subject that people who study Wilde and who follow him will always debate as to how much he willingly faced a trial. Well, in fact, three trials, because he foolishly sued Lord Alfred Douglas's father, the Marquess of Queensberry, who had left an insulting note, a misspelled insulting note, but nonetheless saying to Oscar Wilde, posing as a sodomite, or somdomite, as he wrote. Wilde thought he would sue and end the persecution of the couple that the father had been embarking on. And the case collapsed because the lawyer, who ironically had, not ironically exactly, but unfortunately, had been at Trinity College Dublin with Wilde when Wilde was growing up. And as Wilde said, I'm sure he will pursue the case with all the bitterness of an old friend. And Ned Carson did, and that case collapsed. And this was the opportunity, the pivot of his life, in a way, in which he could have gone to France, as people did. You know, they escaped not that France was exactly tolerant, but it was far less intolerant than Britain. And it was almost as if the establishment was waiting for him to do that, because he was clearly going to be arrested if he stayed. So they gave him some sort of grace, but he stayed and stayed in the Cadogan Hotel. There's a great poem about it by John Betjeman, The Arrest of Oscar Wilde in the Cadogan Hotel, at the Cadogan Hotel, it has a verse, Mr. Wilde, we have come for to take you where felons and criminals dwell. We must ask you to come with us quietly, for this is the Cadogan Hotel. And and there he, the first case against him, the criminal case against him, collapsed. Well, no, it didn't collapse. It was a hung jury. And so it was a third trial that finally found him guilty. And to give you a sense of the time, the magistrate, Lord Justice Wills, said, this is the worst case I have ever tried. And this was a man who had tried cases of child murder. And he said, it's my duty to give you the maximum sentence the law allows, which in my opinion is not severe enough, 2 years at hard labour. And as his solicitor had told Wilde, people of his class were not expected to survive such a... And so, you know, that's 2 years, one wonderful piece of work coming out of it, The Ballad of Reading Gaol, but then exiled to Paris and a pretty grim life of drunkenness and absinthe and misery and penury and begging letters and a death at the age of 46. It is, but in making the film as a sign of what was going on and has been going on since his death, I have this image which I'd love to share with you. It's a very silly one, and you'll think at first, what is he talking about? But it's the only thing that I can compare to what happened when he died in 1900, the subject of the greatest scandal of his age, a figure mired in such scandal, and his name could barely be spoken. And all young people, I mean, for instance, I mean, soldiers used to hold hands in Britain in the way that males hold hands throughout the Arab world and throughout the Mediterranean. You see, you know, boys and men hold hands or with their arms around each other. It's a natural form of affection. It has no sexual meaning. But the moment the wild trial happened, soldiers never held hands again, never put their arms around each other. Men just distant handshakes. Everything changed about maleness, in a sense. And it changed the world. Somerset Maugham writes about this when he was a medical student at the time, terrified as a young gay man himself. But anyway, so this disgrace, Wilde couldn't be sure that his name would ever be uttered again, except as an anathema, as a hissed, you know, as a byword of perversion and filth. And he died in that way. And if you go to New York, this is my image, Manhattan, and you may have done this. If you do it early, about 2 a.m. is a good time. It's a city that never sleeps. You'll easily get a cab to go down Fifth Avenue. And it does go down. It goes downtown Fifth Avenue. And you pass 34th, 33rd streets, and you look round, and you're a new tourist, and the driver might say, and that's the Empire State Building. And you look and you just see the base of it and you think, wow, that's the Empire State Building. And then as the car goes, you turn round and look out of the rear window to see it. And of course, it's blocked by, as you're zooming down, by nearer buildings that are tiny in comparison. But the effect of distance is such that they, of course, fill the eye and you can barely see. But if you get a run of greens, which you can do with the New York traffic light system, and you keep looking out and you go down and down and down and down Herald Square and all that, this marvellous sort of thing happens. The Empire State Building seems to rise like a Saturn V rocket, and up and up and up and up and up it goes up, and all the little buildings just fall away. And you realise how small they are. And the 20th century was like that, I thought, by the time we got to the 90s, we were doing the film. This giant Wilde was obscured by pygmies, literary pygmies, artistic pygmies, philosophical pygmies, who had bigger names. And he was forgotten. You couldn't even see, you just barely see him. And then as the decades passed, he just rose and rose and rose. And we realised what he was and how much he owed. And there came a time in, about 15 or 20 years ago, when the French municipality or arrondissement that in which the Père Lachaise Cemetery is, where he's buried in his sarcophagus by Jacob Epstein, is, there was a move from the Irish government and this arrondissement to restore the sarcophagus. And the reason for it was that the very vulnerable sandstone of which it's made was corroded by the kisses, the repeated kisses on its surface over the decades. And that, to me, was one of the most moving things I could imagine, that this man who, when buried there, might have thought his name was forever filth, has now had his monument restored because of so many people coming on kind of pilgrimages to him. Because he's not just a gay icon. I think he's the prince of Bohemia, of the eternal student, of anyone who still asks questions and doesn't settle down into a bourgeois rut, if you like, but who continues to think of themselves as a scholar gypsy, a bohemian. And he is, I used to visit, students, universities and colleges to give talks and things. And in the early days when I first did it, I was first making a sort of name for myself. I get invited back to student rooms for a cup of tea or a glass of wine or whatever, and they'd all gather around and we'd chat. And I'd notice on the walls you'd see a poster of Karl Marx or, I don't know, Jimi Hendrix. Because the future, if there was going to be a future for the student, was in rock and roll or it was in revolution. But over the years, you'd notice that you didn't see those anymore. Some, you know, the Berlin Wall fell, the Soviet bloc melted away. The idea of Karl Marx being the solution to anything seemed absurd now. And rock and roll music had descended into something very commercial and had, you know, less heroic about it. But instead, you'd see posters of, usually it would be Oscar Wilde and Albert Einstein, because the future of mankind is in the mind, the creative mind. And those two represent it perhaps above all too. They are, to use a word that actually annoys me, they are icons.
They are. Mythological monuments. I don't know. We'll have to come up with something to replace icons. These things, you know, simply seem to pop up and then you can't get away from them. But in addition to his other symbolic significance, certainly a symbol of all who have been wrongfully persecuted for whatever reason.
Absolutely right.
Which brings us to V for Vendetta, which is a film that describes a society, perhaps one that is becoming more ominously familiar, that in which ideas are can be persecuted and in which there can be the most severe consequences for thinking out of turn. Were you familiar with the work before you were cast in it?
Absolutely not, I have to confess. I'd heard of Alan Moore and I'd heard of The Watchman, which I think is one of his graphic novels that is greatly admired. They very kindly, when they offered me this role as a sort of talk show host, comic satirist figure, television satirist, who is a licensed fool within this tyranny that the world, you know, that the story represents, is set in a London, a Britain, which has, you know, fallen into an autocracy and a big brotherish kind of, but much more sort of. Anyway, I won't describe it. People can see the film, but I had not come across it. They sent the graphic novel to me, and I started reading it, and you know. One thing I've had to realize about myself is that most of my brain is taken up with the verbal side of things, with language. And so I've not been a graphic novel reader or a comic reader much in my life. I mean, I've never mind them, but it's I just go straight to the speeches and barely look at the pictures. You know? And so I thought, oh, God, what's it going to be? And the pictures looked interesting. But then I got sucked into the language. Alan Moore, who wrote it, is a genius. It's absolutely astonishing. It's one thing to foresee or to describe a dystopia, a cacotopia, whatever you want to call it, like the one he does, but it comes alive through the most magnificent language, as does the rebellion from within, this character V and the letter V and its meaning as victory, but also as the Roman numeral 5 and the 5th of November, and the Guy Fawkes mask that has now become worldwide a symbol of resistance. It's an absolutely amazing achievement, and I was astonished. And it was produced by the Wachowski brothers, as they called themselves then. And I met with them and the director, Mr. McTeague, James McTeague, a wonderful Australian guy. And it was shot in Germany. I had the enormous pleasure of working with John Hurt, who was a great friend he became and someone I'd always admired. And that was just thrilling. It was a great experience. Joel Silver, the piratical producer, who's a legend in Hollywood, not necessarily beloved everywhere, but goodness knows he gets things done, was very sort of on for this. And, I said, you know, it's quite strong stuff. Will Hollywood allow it? Warner Brothers, you know, who were the studio behind it. And he said, I've persuaded them that it's going to work. And I think the film did work. It didn't do that well. It's done better since as a again, another awful four-letter word, a cult phenomenon, perhaps. But I'm so proud to be a part of it. I loved working with Natalie Portman, too, whom I'd not met. Fearsomely intelligent and fun person. And in fact, the whole crew and everyone involved, I loved the fact, and maybe this is not, you know, stupid English false modesty or anything, but that almost every close-up of every face, except the mask, really, and except Natalie, was of a very lived-in, sort of badly toothed English sort of face. You know, it wasn't pretty Hollywood people. And there was something, I think, jolly led is perhaps the best we can call it, about these close-ups of these figures, Stephen Ray and John Hurt and myself and Tim Pickett-Smith, who's the one who beats me up and shoves me in a sack in the end. But it somehow managed, as all good pieces of work do, I'm deliberately avoiding the word art because it's silly to try and do that, to use the word art all over the place, but a great piece of work, is that they managed to fit so much else in on top of the story without it adding scenes or adding fat to the narrative. And it's always a mystery when I read a great screenplay and I think, how did they get so much in? And it's only 110 pages. And then I try and write one myself and I keep adding scenes and speeches to try and get things across. And I've got to 100 pages and it's not halfway through. And I think, how do they have this marvellous economy that manages still to be so rich? And I thought they did a fabulous job. And as I say, I'm very proud to be a part of it. And I'm always thrilled when young people who were probably barely alive when it was made come up and talk about it. And let's face it, we're now living in a time when the spectre of fascism is no longer hidden from us. And the worship of power, the contempt for the weak, it's all there. And we must pay attention.
And what I found interesting, even though the society is an ostensibly theocratic one, although it uses religion really as a tool for maintaining power rather than being a central tenet of the regime, and even though it is clearly a homophobic society, and your character is gay, the reason that you ultimately meet your demise is not for either of those reasons, but for mocking the leader.
Yes, that's right. That's what he couldn't bear. Yeah, that. And you know, we wish that were true. I mean, I remember when you're growing up, you discuss Hitler, and if only he'd been laughed at more. It's unfortunately, it's nonsense. But one of the great satirists of my age, who I was lucky enough to call a friend towards the last, you know, 10 or 15 years of his life, was Peter Cook, who founded the Establishment Club in London in the 1960s, and who, with Dudley Moore, was a magnificent comic force and an inspiration behind the Pythons and almost every generation of British comics of that kind since. In fact, Woody Allen called him Britain's only comic genius, which was kind of giving with one hand and taking away with the other, but fair enough. I remember a very typical Peter moment when someone said to him, was talking about the Establishment Club in the 60s, and the interviewer said, this is, you know, one of those long microphones they had in the 60s, said, "Well, Mr. Cook, I suppose with the founding of this club, you're doing something like what was done in the Weimar Republic, the extraordinary, powerful and remarkable cabaret and satire scene that went on in the late 20s and early 30s in Berlin." And Peter Cook said, yes, the Café and Cabaret Society of Berlin that did so very much to prevent the rise of Hitler.
Yes, exactly.
You know, bang. You know, it has never been what people wish it were. Charlie Chaplin's Great Dictator did not move the dial a millimetre, I don't think. Not in unfortunately, we kid ourselves. Who knows what the power of social media is to influence these events and to pull down tyrants. At the moment, the power of social media has been more towards being able to build up tyrants, because that's the nature of populism, and it's a populist instrument, and it's an instrument in the hands of people who are not interested, who do not know words that have lost any currency in our society. Honour, probity, those sorts of words are just the kinds of thing that would make you say, no, you can't do that. No, that's dishonourable. It doesn't have a meaning, you know, really. It's like the end of the Roman Republic in that sense. Shakespeare so cleverly used the word honourable, the speech of Mark Antony. Brutus was honourable, but of course he did a dishonourable thing, and that, you know, that sort of moment ended everything as far as the honour and the Republic was concerned. And we have a feeling now about somehow honour having disappeared from our country. And it being useless and being seen as weak, that's the thing. There's a great commencement speech by, I can't remember his first name, Pritzky, the governor, who's from the famous Pritzky family. And he's doing, I think it's for Northwestern University. It's well worth looking up on YouTube if you've got a moment, anybody. And he talks about how it is certainly true that evolution favored aggression and suspicion, suspicion of difference. If people were different and other from your family, your clan, your tribe, your people, then you ousted them, you distrusted them, you bullied them, you beat them out, as animals do to this day. I said, but our evolution didn't stop there. It didn't stop with produce language, amongst other things. It all our modern tool things. So it was. We still have the layer of it, but on top of it, we have a layer of something called intelligence. And it is unintelligent to behave like that. The intelligence that has given us the things that we have is consonant with the intelligence that actually overrides suspicion and finds welcome and empathy and altruism and kindness. And these things are not weakness, as the fascist mind considers, with their total perversion of what they call, you know, social Darwinism or whatever, complete misunderstanding of what it's all about. And actually, it's strength to feel for other people. It's strength to bond with strangers. It's strength to welcome in difference. Of course, you don't lose guardrails on anything. You know, you don't lose common sense. But what has to be fought is the pervasive feeling now that capitalism, in red in tooth and claw, is a good and is somehow an unquestioned good. That's to say that any form of mixed economy with social democracy and so on is just paltering with the brute strength that is the beauty of the winner in life. And this, you know, sort of dim misunderstanding of Nietzsche and this sort of adoption of vague kind of Ayn Randian libertarianism and so on is sort of goes unquestioned because they're so quick with the answer back. And the answer back is liberal elitism. As if that's, I mean, I don't know whether, you know, from billionaires, we're elite, apparently.
They are the common folk in their country clubs. To the word honor, I would add one other seemingly forgotten, and it's a one of mixed significance because sometimes it can be quite negative, but that is shame. And the utter shamelessness of the time we live in, when you hear the statements, the contradictions from one moment to the next.
Almost in the same sentence, yes.
Right, the vulgarity of the utterance coming from people who, you know, in a previous generation, no leader, no person who was held up to statespersonship would ever have allowed such things to escape their lips. And I don't only refer to one country because I think it's become quite endemic.
It has, pervasive, and of course they have sealed off all routes to criticism because if you were to talk about the honourable and the ability to shame people of the past, then they just come back at how it was the people in the past that built, like FDR and so on, who built the rot that they are now pulling away as they hollow out. The federal system in America.
Right, people owning their own homes and, you know, not being able to go to school and not, you know, starving to death in old age and, you know, those terrible, rotten things.
Exactly.
Anyway, well, of course we've taken, as is our wont, a few detours. So,
yes, sorry.
And I do want to get on to my second major, but if you could just give me a couple of quick reflections of working with Robert Altman on Gosford Park. Well, we won't need to linger long there, but...
No. It was, of course, a great honor. I'd admired his films hugely, and this script arrived. It seemed to me a very un-Altman-esque milieu. But then, of course, he shows that he's a master of all milieu because he's a master of people, and the milieu is not exactly incidental. He'll use it and refine it and use it, but always to do with people. And... one of my favorite films of his is A Wedding, and as with Nashville too, you encounter all these people without explanation. And in the first 10 minutes, you think, I'm never going to know who they all are. But somehow you do. Somehow they all, you get the connections between them all. And he directs like that. And he said, I hired you, so, I don't know how to act. You do. So I'm not going to tell you how to act. If I don't like it, it's not going to end up in the movie. So, you know, just act well. That's all I ask of you. I'll be doing the cameras. And he said, like, if I come up to you and say anything, it'll be, I don't like those shoes. That'll be it. and it was true. And it began, Clive, the cameraman, he had two cameras, both of which were on tracks, which is quite unusual to have two on tracks like that. And he would do a scene. He'd just call us all in. There'd be, who was it? Maggie Smith, Eileen Atkins, Michael Gambon, Alan Bates. You know, I mean, extraordinary cast. Incredible to work with such people. And we would just do the scene and bump into each other. The cameras would bash into each other. And then he'd just say a few things to Clive and not say much to us. And somehow this kind of ballet would emerge. And Maggie Smith, who, God bless her, could be a sort of curmudgeonly cuss. You know, she loved to moan, but it was always so comic that everybody was laughed when she moaned. But she said, oh, God, I wish every fucking film was like this. She said, this is amazing. She was so happy. She absolutely loved the experience. It was sad. It was almost his last film. I think he made Prairie Home Companion after that, didn't he?
Which I also love.
Which I love too, and yeah. I wish he'd lasted longer. I mean, you know, he'd spark up a joint first thing in the morning, and that would be hanging from his mouth as he directed. But he was a lovely man. You know, every time the camera stopped, I would sidle up, and as long as he wasn't busy talking to someone else, we'd fall into conversation, and he'd talk about his early days doing live TV dramas, and that's where he made his bones. And he was fearsomely intelligent, but like a lot of Americans of his stamp, his outward affect and manner was that of like John Huston, like all those sort of people.
Right.
Was of
John
a sort
Ford.
Of, yeah, was in the Hemingway tradition, and in that's wouldn't put up with any artistic nonsense. If you said anything vaguely artsy to him, he'd go, well, I don't know about that. You know, and yeah, Howard Hawks, the same. And these are the greatest artists in film history, of course.
Exactly. Well, onto a big subject, which I really would appreciate your reflections on, art in an AI world. First of all, just to start, has the world yet witnessed the appearance of a deep fake Stephen Fry?
Oh, yes, years ago, actually. I mean, more originally in sound. I was sent almost, I think, 3 years ago, I was sent a piece of a documentary which was about the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands, oddly enough. It was all black and white, but with me doing the narration. And I was sent it sort of out of the blue saying, oh, this is really good. When did you do it? And I watched it and heard my voice and thought, I just don't remember doing that. Now, I'm afraid I'm going to be 68 in August. This happens to me a lot. People will send me a YouTube link to a sketch I did with Hugh Laurie, for example, and I'll look at it and I'll send it to Hugh and say, do you have any memory of doing this? Do you have any sense of what the next line is going to be, where it's going to end? And he'll go, oh, my God, no. But it is us. So I felt that with this. And I read it back saying, I'm awfully sorry, I can't help you because I don't know when they did it. And they said, ha-ha, we're a company that makes voices for people of their own voice. And that wasn't you. It was based on the data set, which is the 7 Harry Potter novels that you narrated back from 95 or so onwards as audiobooks. And they use that as their data set, as they say. And but what was clever, of course, is they chose this particular story because it's full of German and Dutch names, which are not in the Harry Potter books. It was to show that although it was used for my voice, not for particular words, allophones and all that. So I was astonished, sent it to my agent. As I say, so this was before the writer's strike or the actor's strike. So it was some time ago. And my agent in Britain was going, oh, my God, I didn't know this. And he sent it to my American agents, and they flipped, and they had meetings with other agents. Other actors were beginning to understand that this is happening now. And so a few of them started. I think, who was it? Anyway, one of the big Hollywood actors, she made a big fuss about her likeness being used. And so it's become a thing. And as a writer, I was aware a couple of years ago that all my books have been scraped by the current large language models. ChatGPT is the one everyone knows, of course, but there are others and there are specialist ones now. And yes, so I We can't get that toothpaste back in the tube, as far as I can tell. I think a government can order OpenAI to remove the various stolen pieces of copyright from the data sets that are being used by these models. That's past it. They can stop. They can stop making new material, stop using the generative part, the G of GPT, which is the stuff that makes things, supposedly makes things, so it can obviously comes up with sentences, but also makes pictures on prompts and video on prompts and music on prompts. Now, as Elton John has said in a recent letter, amongst many others, which was written trying to urge our Prime Minister to be careful about this in his embrace of AI, they now know my style. They now know how I write. They now know the kind of music I write. And with each iteration of these models, what will happen is that they will get better and better, therefore writing using the Elton John style. So I have, I almost want to show it to you. I did, again, this is years ago, Midjourney, which is one of the better generative image creators. And I will show you this because it's an example that, again, this is at least 3 years old. I've got it in my favourites, so it won't take a sec to find. he lied. Everything. Yeah, here we are. Now, you can see. I asked it to do me in the style of Degas, and it did that very, very quickly.
Isn't that marvellous?
So that's painting in the style of Degas. So yes. Write a song in the style of Elton John. And it might be one that could fool just about everybody. And it of course, provokes an enormous number of questions. What is creativity? What is it? Human intelligence? Is it something that we alone have? If it can be reproduced in this way, what have we got left? And we're standing on a smaller and smaller island, and we're surrounded by the waters of technology that have taken over all the domains and all the magisteria that we thought were ours. And we're left, about to drown with nothing exceptionalist in the human story left. And that worries us, obviously it worries us. That is a worry on one side. I'm currently more worried about the actual extinction of the human race, not the extinction of the human artistic spirit, although that is, of course, an enormous catastrophe. But have you heard of P. Doom? P. Doom is, it's a bit like the doomsday clock that nuclear scientists and others suggest how far we are away from doomsday, according to world political tension. At the moment, we're 2 minutes from midnight, I think, or something rather disturbing. That's the nuclear threat. Well, P. Doom is the equivalent. It's the percentage, it's expressed in percentages, of likelihood of doomsday being caused by superintelligence in an AI machine. Now, one of the leading figures in it, Liesl Udowski and Nat Soares have just written a book called If Anyone Buys It, Everyone Will Die. Sorry, if anyone builds it, everyone will die.
Right.
not if everyone buys their book. He has a 90% P-doom. That's what he's suggesting, that there is a 90% chance that the human race will be extinguished by AI. The lowest is, there are some who say, it's a 2% chance. So if you ignore the Sam Altmans and the world who have a vested economic interest in saying that AI is safe, the lowest tends to be about 5%, which is a low. But the average amongst people who understand it, the Stuart Russells and Geoffrey Hintons and Demis Hassabis of this world, the Nobel Prize winners, the fathers and authors of AI, if you like, the ones who made it all possible, but who don't have a financial stake in it because they're academic and because they're decent people, they have honour and shame, as we've discussed, they would put it at around 20% as if you average out what most people's doing it. Well, the chances of winning a lottery are 0.000022. That's five zeros. And you're comparing that to 20%. Russian roulette is what it must be
20%.
16.666.
Right.
Yeah, and so you know, there's a greater chance of the human extinction than you'll shoot your brains out in your first shot at Russian roulette. So you know, these are not inconsiderable risks, considering that what they're risking is the end of absolutely everything. You make your bet according to the size of the pot. So you know, the reason people bet in such huge numbers on such an unlikely chance as the lottery is because the reward is so enormous. And so when you have at 20% where the risk is enormous, it's a reverse bet of a catastrophic nature. And nobody's doing, and there is legislation about gambling. There are regulations and guardrails. There is nothing protecting us from super intelligent AI. And I think Dan Dennett, the American philosopher, whom I knew a little through our mutual atheism, I wrote a foreword to the book, The Four Horsemen of the Atheist Apocalypse thing. And he was a fascinating man. And he made an interesting point. He said, you know, it's very difficult to use the word regulation in the current culture because everybody screams, all the right-wingers and all the capitalists scream immediately that regulation is the most evil thing ever, and it's a bar to freedom, bar to everything. And he said, but what you must consider is that the thing they most love, money, which is actually the greatest and most transformational technology that mankind ever produced, more so than the printing press even, money would not work without regulation that is agreed across the world. Even rogue states sign up to the idea of currency and money. And counterfeiting it would, you know, to have a law that said it's okay to counterfeit money. The most savage red and tooth and claw capitalist, you know, Elon Musk would not argue with that. You can't, you know, you have to have a fixed system. Well, if you can do it with money, you've got to be able to do it with this new thing, this new entity.
If it's even possible.
Yeah.
But not to be macabre about it, but as you describe the risk, it strikes me that the London bookies might have quite an interesting race on their hands. Who comes in first, nukes, climate change, or AI in terms
exactly.
of...
That's exactly right. We're facing a tsunami of different currents that have all conjoined. Also, we're living at the political time which is least able to bring people together, where any sort of global cooperation, the very word global is anathema to a lot of the leaders of the world. I mean, if you jump from Trump to Meloni to Erdogan to Lukashenko to Putin to Xi to Mohammed bin Salman and Milei in, a lot of them begin with M, don't they? Milei in Argentina now, you know, there is this nexus of populist autocrats who all share the same contempt for global, whether it's the World Health Organization, the UN, NATO, whatever it is, anybody that comes together, World Banks and so on. And that any post-war consensus unity has gone.
Yes. So we have laid ourselves bare. And at the same time, we're told by the titans of tech industry, all is well. These are just tools for enhancing productivity. They're going to unleash your creativity. Meanwhile, they're bringing out AI-powered weaponry that presumably are undefeatable. And we have people like the recent Nobel Prize winner Geoffrey Hinton, and you know, warning, and as did Stephen Hawking, about the that AI could lead to the end of humanity.
That's what I'm saying, the P-doom, yeah.
Right. And I'm reminded that Yuval Noah Harari suggested that a sufficiently advanced AI would be as superior in its ability as we fancy ourselves to be to animals. And why would we expect AI to treat us more kindly than we treat them?
That's exactly right. And I read that book, Nexus, and he made some very good points in it. And one of the points he made is, what possible reason could we have to trust the tech bros, given what they did with social media? I mean, they made the same claims of how it would join the world together and we'd all be happy. Instead, it's done the absolute opposite. And you can see
Well, when but the Facebook, Wii was themselves, and they're very happy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yes, but that's it, because they have no concern or interest in human happiness, although they give that as the excuse for why their technology is great. But that's what I mean. We have no reason to trust them whatsoever. And if you look at Facebook, I mean, it was never appealing to me, I have to say, that schooly nature of it. But it grew and grew and grew from Harvard to the Ivy Leagues to other universities, to universities in Britain and Europe and then around the world. And all the time was free, completely free. So it relied on investors and a few people, a man called Peter Thiel, for example, and others thought that there was some juice in this, and he smartly invested in it, but he kept giving money, and eventually he's sitting around a table with Zuckerberg and saying, when are we going to make any money out of this? All we've done is give this free service to people, and we obviously need our payback now. And the answer was advertising. Well, that seems fair. The other answer, incidentally, would have been subscription, which I would have preferred infinitely, a Netflix model, if you like. You subscribe to belong to it and there's no adverts. But unfortunately, they went for the advertising. And so people like Martin Sorrell, one of the big cheeses in world advertising, and others sat down and they realized that with this technology, they could do a new kind of advertising, a targeted advertising that could follow what people were interested in and give them those advertisements. And the more people showed their interest, the more places they went, the more they'd know about them, and the more they could advertise. And this was a good thing. And so as Noah Yuval Harari points out in Nexus, that a little algorithm was sent out into their Facebook world, which had a two-word mission, one that seemed innocent at the time. No psychologist or anyone else said this is dangerous. It was maximize engagement. But what no one had foreseen was that you maximize engagement not through puppies and golden kittens and moonlight. You maximize engagement through resentment, hate, fear, envy, anger, rivalry, all the dark emotions, the whole Pandora's box of the worst emotions that humans have is what engages them, whereas love and peace and joy does not engage. It makes them go and skip in the countryside, which is a good thing. So as this grew and grew and grew, as the snowball of this algorithm grew, the money rolled in to such an extent, the world utterly changed. And of course, Facebook then went public, and it now has shareholders and indeed the not the shareholders individually, the people who run the shareholding groups, the brokers, if you like, all of them, they have no care. And they always claim so innocently and so in such a hurt voice that they're constitutionally obliged to make the most money. And it's not our fault. I mean, come on.
That's made up, by the way. Sole responsibility being profit maximization was just made up.
Yeah, of course it was. It's absolute nonsense. And pension funds say it, which are pension funds on behalf of good people who
right.
deserve their pension. So if you then question them, they say, we're working for these marvelous post office workers or these train guards, and we're making their pension more richer. Do you want us to make less money for them? And it's all so disingenuous. But the fact of the matter is, as we've seen, that this. In Britain, as you may know, our rivers are a scandal at the moment. They're just full of raw effluent and appallingly impure. And our cultural rivers are now like this. Children are asked to swim in waters full of turds and effluent, and they're asked to breathe in from a very early age a culture that is contaminated, that the social networks that they're on are contaminated. And people are starting to do things about it. Jonathan Haidt has been very hate. I think he actually pronounces it, unfortunately, doesn't he? He's been influential. And there are towns and communities in Britain now banning mobile phones for children and so on. And it's beginning to have an effect, perhaps. I don't know. But the fact is, we have seen how you cannot entrust wild, loose, libertarian capitalists with the power of the technology that is now around them, that government control may sound like some tyrannical idea, but if in the right hands of, in the way that the nuclear, there was an atomic commission headed by Johnny von Neumann, the greatest scientist of the 20th century, many would say. A weird fellow, and well worth discovery if people don't know about Johnny von Neumann. There was a belief, at least in some form of authority, that had been earned and that was not tainted by a capital a capitalist need, you know, or connection. I was just trying to remember the reason I broke down there was I was talking about my dear friend Bill Goldman, the screenwriter William Goldman. He wrote amongst many other things, Butch Cassidy, obviously, but The Princess Bride, and there's a great line in it. I'm trying to remember what it is. It's something like whatever the phrase is. Let's say it's trust me, and he says, anyone who says that is trying to sell you something. And that's really the point. It's if they're trying to sell you something, then fine, you listen to their sales pitch, but don't put them in charge of weaponry or which is what, you know, things. And this terrifying Russian roulette, a game that we are playing, and it's the four C's, I think, Brian, that we have to, three C's, but we'll find there's a fourth as well. But it's countries, the corporations taking complete command, not through agencies and so on, but actually through their autocrats, wanting supremacy in this field, just as they wanted nuclear supremacy. But it's obviously a much harder one to control than nuclear power. And the end disaster is just as great for us, at least. And so there's the countries, and then there's commerce or corporations, companies. That's the second C. And the third one, of course, and always has been with technologies, is criminals, who can leverage and do what they like with this technology to make our lives unbearable. I mean, simply impossible. Those are the things we have to dam against. I mean, if we imagine now changing metaverse, this is a torrent that is coming our way, or this is a real tsunami. And I've often said, you know, the human family is sitting with its back to the ocean playing beach cricket or whatever you play in Canada. You can't play beach hockey, can you? I suppose, well, you probably can, being Canadian.
Beach volleyball, two months a year.
So you're playing that, and behind you, these different waves are forming into that tsunami. And that's what the position we're in now. Our back is to it, and we haven't really faced it, and the politicians haven't faced it.
No, well, they're especially culpable. And I have to say, the flip side of that maximum engagement is its consumerist manifestation, which I call maximum passivity. So the idea of keeping the public asleep, the protests of the past that were en masse and really within living memory, for example, against the invasion of Iraq. There were mass protests all over the world. And it is now the, and whether it's a combination of people having less affluent and less comfortable and less secure lives, whether it is, you know, spending their lives staring at a small screen, being targeted to be focused on the next gizmo gadget or consumer trend or celebrity trend. But I worry about the
lack. Yeah, you're right.
Yes.
And it sort of reminded me that, we should pay attention to writers, to artists, because they've all seen this coming before, really a lot of them before scientists in many ways. And obviously Orwell is often cited when it comes to the autocracy, but we shouldn't forget Aldous Huxley, who in many ways was more correct in Brave New World than Orwell. I mean, obviously lots of Orwell is incredibly prescient, but the nightmare for Huxley was consumerism. And he invented this drug, Soma, that the people in Brave New World take that just makes them happy and peaceful. And they genuinely are happy. So there is a kind of philosophical question. Is it wrong to make people happy? We thought from Plato onwards, that's what human beings need to be. And if a drug can make them happy, and they really are happy, you know, they're not zombified. They are just genuinely happy, and they skip about the place. And that was the terror, as far as Huxley was concerned. He came from a scientific family, of course. And science fiction has foreseen so much of what we're living through. And obviously, it would have been weird to have legislation based on reading Asimov or something. But nonetheless,
well, why not? Why not? Why not? In fact. Just to sort of circle around to a different aspect of this and back to Harari, he talks about a future in which there will be an increasingly large segment of the population that he calls the useless class, people who...
Yes, like the gammas in Huxley's Brave New World, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, because they no longer have meaningful work, they really have no functional contribution to society. And if you then apply the logic of, let's say, the modern Ayn Randian version of economic thinking, you know, there they are. They are consuming resources. They are defecating. They're expelling carbon dioxide. What good are they? And, you know, it's only a hop, skip, and a jump to another dystopian future where there are, you know, Eloy and Morlocks.
Yes. Wells got there too. Yeah, you're right.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, so how long before we're all part of, you'll excuse the pun, we're all part of the meat generation.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. No, you're right. And I mean, that might, because the main threat that superintelligent AI poses is generally considered to be what's known as the alignment problem, is that you naturally would try and align your AI with human values, such as you see them, so that the equality of the genders and the races, that we're all equally valuable and that there is no one is more valuable than anybody else, and that there are certain things that are unacceptable, that are dark and forbidden and so on. And you try and align it with these values. But the trouble is we can't really express our own values. And the literality and the particularity of these systems and the power of its thinking and its so on is it's almost trained to overcome any obstacle towards the goal you've set it through your prompts. And it could easily make the point that you have that we want to make one human value is to be good for the environment and to reduce carbon emissions and utility and usefulness are good things because, yes, that Ayn Randian, as you say, also super consequentialism, you know, the hyper utilitarianism, as it were, the best for most people, it might easily make the calculation. And utilitarianism is about calculation. I mean, even Bentham used the phrase calculus of felicity. The calculation that, as you say, these gammas, these useless people, were much better instantly stopped. And it could do it because if people are saying, yeah, but how can an AI kill someone? It's not a robot and we don't have the robots yet that can do it. Well, there are all kinds of ways that once they connect themselves and are connected to the internet, which they are. It's where they're, obviously we question them and so on. There's some wonderful scenarios that sound kind of, are you serious, Stephen? They can blackmail people. They can send them things. They can, they can blackmail other people to kill other people. They can find out who are psychopathic just by looking at all their, you know, activity and traffic on the internet, they can exactly find out who it is who is useful for them to achieve their goal. It sounds ridiculous what I'm saying, but these are things that are being thought out and put down on paper by people far more brilliant than me and who have far more understanding of how these things work. And when I say how these things work, actually nobody understands how they work. They understand how to build a large language model. They understand the various processes of vectors and weights and the extraordinary, you know, Bayesian science and the other things that goes into the construction of it. But they don't know what it's doing. Once they start it up, they actually have no idea. And you can ask Geoffrey Hinton, whom you quoted, and you can ask Stuart Russell, and you can ask the really best brains in this field. They say, no, nobody knows. You set it going, you wait for the output, and then you try and reverse engineer into how it may have come to this decision, but you can't really know. No one knows how it works. That's pretty terrifying.
You wind it up, you let it go, and then you hope it doesn't turn around and kill you. Boy, that's a really great business plan.
Isn't it?
I love that. Isn't that? Yes. Two last things before we leave this, because it is a bit of a downer.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I don't know if you're... No. I started it, so, you know, you've just illuminated it. I don't know if you're familiar, because we've been on this path for a long time in one respect, where, you know, the human endeavor, it gets replaced by various... forms of technology, of which AI is the latest and most powerful incarnation. But I don't know if you're familiar with the book by the late anthropologist David Graeber called Bullshit Jobs?
No, I love the title.
Oh, it's a wonderful book. It's basically, he started off with a little essay wondering, as he had encountered a great deal of bureaucracy, how many jobs were bullshit, that they actually were things that people spent their lives doing that accomplished absolutely nothing of value. And in fact, because they accomplished nothing of value, created a negative effect on the minds and souls of the people who were consigned to doing them, especially if they were well compensated. And this one article led to a torrent of people explaining the kind of bullshit that they had to do all day long and how it actually made society less productive. He ultimately ended up doing a complete study of it and came to the conclusion that in the Western world, partly to keep people occupied and from rioting in the streets, that these jobs had been created as their meaningful functions had been made redundant, that, you know, there were five categories that he classified as flunkies, goons, duct tapers, box tickers, and taskmasters. But that they actually made society less productive, made the people who did them less happy, but they couldn't leave them because they were well paid, and that between 30 and 50% of jobs in modern society were what he categorized as bullshit jobs. So that leads me to say that when you add AI to the mix, I suggest that the promise is not that AI will liberate humanity. It's a bit of a fantasy, but it may only empower the people who own the AI until the AI decides that the owners are useless too, and then they end up among the Eloi.
Yes,
the menu.
We can certainly look to the side of AI, which offers innumerable and unimaginable blessings. And we mentioned Geoffrey Hinton, the other Nobel Prize winner last year for chemistry was Demis Hassabis, who really was the great genius behind AlphaGo, which defeated the world, you know, Lisa Doll, the world Go champion in the complexities of Go. And when I talk about the complexities of Go, wow, I mean, chess has a very high, what's known as a Shannon number, which essentially means, and people always find this hard to believe, but I'm afraid it's true, that there are more possible moves on the chessboard, more possible games of chess, than there are atoms in the visible universe. Well, Go is almost infinitely more complex than that. And so a brute force computer could never hope to do it. And so it was Demis Hassabis who found this way of this reinforced deep learning. You hear this phrase, machine learning, deep learning, unsupervised, then becomes, so the machine teaches itself. And that was a breakthrough of monumental proportions. But that's not why he got the Nobel Prize. He got the Nobel Prize because his company was bought by Google, but he insisted on hiving off part of it to form AlphaFold. And in medicine and chemistry, there has been this long understanding that the complexities of proteins which fold into unique and complex shapes, the complexities are so great that classical computing, i.e. computing that uses ones and zeros, binary computing, could never solve it. You'd have to wait till quantum computing came on stream before you could begin to unfold the mystery of the protein. And behind that, of course, lies incredible help for people with Huntington's, with Alzheimer's, with all kinds of diseases and so on. It's a real alchemist's gold quest. And he managed, with AlphaGold, which he left and which he founded, leaving behind all the profits and all the money that he could have made at Google, this company, and he solved it. His AIs unfolded the proteins. There are currently 2 million scientists working on instances of AlphaFold that he has given freely to the medical and academic community. And that is a sign that there are people with honor. There are people who understand that science can be a gift and that technology can release us from all kinds of torments and sorrows. And so it isn't all a story of gloom and doom. He's a remarkable man, and he's not alone. That there are others around, and their voices need to be heard. Instead of seeing Elon Musk on the front page of newspapers every damn day, we should see the faces of people like this and listen to them and attend to what they have to teach us.
Exactly. And one parting thought on that, on the P-Doom. It may be, for those who are a little bit disenchanted with humanity, that despite all the positive things we've created, like the Great Wall of China and St. Mark's Cathedral and St. Peter's and marmalade, absolutely, and love and sharing and compassion. But if we come to the conclusion that the bad outweighs the good and we're only going to get what we deserve, then my final rejoinder is, what did the lemurs ever do to deserve this?
Very good. Absolutely. Thank you.
You know, we're responsible for them, too. All right. Well, I think we've probably come to an end. Perhaps, you know, after a suitable passage of time, the last remaining bit that I still hope for to discuss with you in the future, which is the music of language and the language of music, that we may get to that. But I think we have probably utilized our time. So perhaps if I can prevail upon you to return at some point in the not-too-distant future, assuming that the P-Doom hasn't overtaken us first.
Yes. If our robot overlords allow it.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there may be a way out. I don't know if you saw the movie Colossus, the Forbin Project. It was from the late 70s. It was a television movie. And that was a supercomputer that basically decided that we were too self-destructed, so it had to take over for our own sake, and that we would ultimately not only learn to obey it as it preserved us from destruction, but made our lives extremely unpleasant as it imposed its rule, but that ultimately we would learn to love it.
Oh, that's right. And maybe that's already happened, and that's the god that some people still worship.
I hope not that one.
I know, I hope not too. Anyway, lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much,
Steve. Until our next merry meeting.
All right. Music of language and language of music.
You got yourself a goddamn deal.
The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to keep bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca, and follow us across social media at the Glenn Gould Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Gould Standard.